Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Empire Radio. I'm your host, Rob Leo. Hope everyone's having a good morning so far. It's 8 a.m. here in the East Coast in New York. Got a nice day ahead of us, and it's been a beautiful week so far. And very excited to welcome back to the show for part three of the extended series that we're doing with her, Sarah Molino. I think we have her on the line right now. Sarah, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
All right. It's great to have you back on the show. I hope
that you're
feeling all good this morning.
Yes. Great.
All right.
Glad to be with you.
All right. Well, Sarah, this is part three, obviously, of the three-part extended series that we've been doing with you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's been obviously an interesting discussion that we've been having over the course of these episodes now. And today, you know, I'd like to kind of focus, you know, more along the lines of the current situation and how everything that you've been involved with as far as, you know, your teaching goes over at Guilford, you know, how things have progressed and how, you know, you see us as a society evolving and, you know, really changing the views that you know, were set into place, you know, from years upon years ago. But before we get into all that, why don't you just very briefly just give a brief introduction on yourself and, you know, what it is that you have done.
Okay, thank you. I have taught for 34 years at a place called Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina, and my focus has been in U.S. history on the matters of race, class, gender, and ethnicity. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, in a Jewish family, and I I'm giving you my educational background today. I studied in Boston at Wellesley College as an undergraduate, and then did my graduate work in New York at Columbia University in the early 70s. And so it was a very tumultuous time, and those times certainly influenced both what I studied. This was a new subject at the time, and from the perspective of the ordinary person, and I also worked on women's history, and I was in fact one of the first people, or the first person actually, to do a dissertation in women's history. So that's in brief my background.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
And so Sarah, now, obviously, you know, we've discussed how student reactions and, you know, a lot of times, obviously, it's a challenge for teachers, especially, you know, in dealing with such sensitive topics, you know, as race and as women's rights and equality.
Right.
You know, it's tough to kind of toe the line of what's appropriate, we'll say, you know, to kind
mm-hmm.
of say and to view. So I'm curious on your end, you know, if it ever became frustrating, you know, to you as a professor to try to get certain ideas across or try to teach basically certain events.
Well, I wouldn't say frustrating, but I usually at the beginning of a class would explain who I was. I would say to them, I'm from this Jewish background. I have a particular perspective. I also call myself a feminist, and especially in the course that was once women's history in the U.S. and ended up as gender and power in the U.S. That was a course where it was very important to explain my perspective as a feminist, because the work of doing women's history and doing gender history is a feminist project. And so from the outset, I had to say who I was and what I was about. And then I would invite students and I said, look, you don't have to take any particular perspective on these issues, but I want you to know where I'm coming from. And then I hope that you will share with me your reactions to what I have to say. And if you don't agree with me, fine. And that's really important for for the learning process and for us to understand each other is to understand also where the what you bring to the classroom. And I would also point out to them that I wanted to make the classroom a safe space so that
right.
we could have a conversation with each other. I don't know if we talked about this before, but we could have a conversation with each other on things that were going to be hard and that would raise emotional issues. And but at the same time, the classroom was just a classroom. In some ways, it emulates what society is, but in other ways, it really doesn't. And so, you know, I hoped that this would be an opportunity for them to talk about what they really thought about things and not feel as though they were being judged by me or by their classmates. And so I wrote this on the syllabus, and I emphasize it at various points through the discussion so that people would be aware that we were going to be dealing with tough things and that they might have an emotional reaction to it, and that they could learn how to cope with it and how to express themselves on these tough issues.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so as far as general appreciation for that you,
mm-hmm.
you know, were able to give students that, did you feel that love and that general respect from your students?
For the most part. I mean, occasionally students would get angry with me for certain things, and you know, they're entitled to. I mean, I didn't expect them. My job wasn't to make them love me or adopt my views. My job was to provoke their own thinking about these questions and to encourage their own thinking about it. And, you know, we could agree to disagree. And I also made clear that I really was interested to hear what they thought from where they came from and where they were in a cultural and social and political way on these issues. On the issues of women's rights, on the issues of gender equality, on the issues of the future of gender relationships, and so on. So we, you know, it was both a study of the past, but it also was to think about. It also was to encourage them in these particular courses. I did this with the gender and power course, then I also did it in my upper level social history class, but I did it to some extent also in the introductory courses. I made sure that there was plenty of study of women in my lower level courses. I wanted to stake out who I was so that they would be able to then establish their own identities in relationship and their own views in relationship to these ideas. So I don't know if that answers your question exactly.
No, it definitely does.
Mm-hmm.
And so now to move on to a bit to what I wanted to focus on for today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, as far as minority and women's rights, how have you seen the evolution, you know, back from when you were, you know, I mean, back in the 60s and the 70s and,
right.
and up till today?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, one very significant step is that we do have a pretty successful female candidate running for president today.
Mm-hmm.
However, we also, you know, what I've learned from studying history is that often steps are made by a small group in a particular direction. It has an impact on certain policies, laws, etc., and then there often is a reaction against it. So what I've seen is that, and I think we're now at a very at a particular political moment where there's a tough fight going on about the presence of women and granting of the issues that people have been fighting for since the women have been fighting, women active rights activists, I should say, have been fighting for since, you know, the 19th century. They were talking about issues like birth control and abortion in the 19th century. And
right.
So the effort that was called in the 19th century, the woman movement, and then we had another way, and that might be the first wave of feminism. We had a second wave of feminism. Some historians refer to in the late 60s, early 70s, in which there was a lot of vocal expression of protest against the gender hierarchy, in which men are at the top and women are somewhere below. And it's not only women, it's obviously it's not just women in general. The hierarchy really is white men, white women, black women, black men, and lumped together with people of color are also Latinos and Asian people and so on. So there's a mix of ethnicities in the way and a question of who has the most power in this society. And I think we're in a real tough fight over who is going to dictate what policies will follow in the government. And, you know, the issue of, for example, will follow what policies the government will follow. For example, only in the 1980s did the issue of abortion, and really with the Reagan election, abortion, women's rights, the ERA, the issues of birth control, and so on, become part of the public agenda. No presidential candidate before that talked about these issues, and yet they became a kind of litmus test for seeing whether or not somebody is conservative enough or too liberal. And so that issue of how do you stand on the matter of abortion, you know, was a question that was raised to political candidates, and that was something new that happened in the post-Vietnam era. It was a reaction against the vote, against the changes that had taken place in the 70s, the passage of laws that said, for example, that birth control to unmarried women was legal, the court cases that supported affirmative action, all of those changes, and for example, in before the women's rights movement of the 60s, before the National Organization of Women was founded in 1966, in the newspaper you would read "Help Wanted Male, Help Wanted Female." And one of the things that this organization took up was that they should get rid of classifications like that in the newspaper, that jobs should be available to both men and women, and that,
right,
you know, the employer could decide. So those are changes that have taken place and that are, you know, we don't see that anymore. And we certainly also see, as a result of affirmative action, many more women in positions of authority, and many more women and women of color and so on in the positions of authority. And yet there's still a struggle going on about this. And I would say our presidential candidates, the debates that are going on now among presidential candidates and that are going on in legislatures are around these issues. And it's really unfortunate. And into the mix now, of course, is much more public discussion of homosexuality and and the transgendered population. And
right.
So, you know, so all of those things have now come to the fore as significant political issues. So that's you know, a change. I remember when I was a child, my father took me to hear John Kennedy when he was running for office, And I remember him talking about the waltz. It was one step forward and two steps back. And he said this is he was characterizing the opposite party, but I think that this is the pattern that we see in the evolution of support for real social change around the issues of gender equality and the acceptance of a variety of non-white populations.
Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, with everything going on, obviously, election year is huge on every sort of issue. You have, and like you mentioned earlier, you know, you have a female candidate right now that looks like she's going to be the at least the Democratic candidate, definitely.
Right. That's a big deal.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, especially for our country. I mean, we're coming off of the first African American president.
Right.
And
right.
Now we could be possibly headed into this. But, I mean, as far as that goes, I mean, are there things that you think that Hillary Clinton could kind of benefit from focusing on, you know, to really drive her run here?
Well, I really think she's doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
She does her homework. She knows the issues. She has incredible experience, and I'm giving away here my political bias, but she has experience of, you know, of having been as the Secretary of State and having to negotiate with international, with international personalities and around very difficult issues. And I do think that she will bring to the table the perspective of being a woman, and that's different. That is different. I mean, there are studies that show that men's brains and women's brains work a little differently, and that they think about matters in different ways. And I think that she, you know, because she's had to be a diplomat, she knows that that much can come out of a diplomatic approach to foreign affairs, for example, as opposed to we'll bomb these guys out of existence kind of approach to foreign affairs.
Right.
Which has proved to be fairly unsuccessful. So
sure.
I think you know, she does have, and she certainly also has worked for the rights of women and children. She gave a very important speech in 1995 at the first International Women's Rights Convention in Beijing, in which she talked about the international oppression of women and tried to say, you know, it's time now for us to fight for our rights. And it was very powerful at that time, and it created groups of women in various countries around the world who began to think about their roles in a new way. And it, you know, I hate the expression empower, but it did do that for many women in many places. And so I think, you know, that is certainly an important, and then there have been more international conferences of women in which women from many, many countries have come. And so they've seen their lives in a different way as a result of the kind of leadership that Clinton has provided. So I think she has a lot to offer. And I think Donald Trump, who looks like he's going to be the Republican nominee, maybe, has said many derogatory things about women in his campaign.
Yes.
And he certainly has also evoked an enormous amount of bigotry concerning different ethnic groups. And so we've really got two polar opposite candidates, and it will be really interesting to see what happens.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's they really are, and It's funny to me because people always talk about it during the election year. Oh, you're always going for the lesser of two evils, and everyone has their skeletons, and you really could not have two people that seem more different and are going to try to pull the voters in separate directions.
There are many women who support Hillary, but I've also talked to a number of women who really don't like her. And so it's interesting to hear their what bothers them about her. And I think I don't know how widespread this view is, but it'll be an interesting it will be fascinating to watch.
Now, how do you think that this is going to affect the future? I mean, obviously you kind of said it, you're kind of scared with a guy like Trump because he has made comments and they have been less than flattering towards minorities, and which, he always tries to kind of back tread on, which it seems, the closer that he knows he's getting to actually being the Republican candidate, he's going to kind of backstep and say, I didn't really mean it like that. Do you think
all his advisors will tell him to do that? Yeah.
Well, of course, yeah. But so, I mean, do you see that when it comes to this? I mean, obviously, you're getting through an election year, you're trying to build up trust. Do you think that it's going to be that big of a difference between the two if we were to go, say Hillary is president? Do you see that issues of equality for both minorities and women are going to be more focused on, whereas with Trump they'd be a lot less?
I certainly do. I mean, I think she has been very careful in her presentations in debates not to promise more than she can deliver. And I think that is really, political candidates often do promise much more than they can deliver. And she's done her homework. She's got all these policy papers. She's really thought about all the hard issues that a president would have to face. And I think that, certainly one of the issues that she's talked about consistently in the in her campaign is inequality for women. I mean, even equal pay for equal work. They were talking about that. And there's, in the 1848, there was something written, an incredible statement written by a group of women who met at Seneca Falls, New York. It's the first women's rights convention. And what they said was, "We hope that women will be compensated for their work in the same way that men are." So that issue has been around for a long time, and it sort of shocks me in a way that we're still talking about it. But we are, and the data shows that women are not only are they paid, I think, it's now 77 cents on a dollar, it was 59 cents on a dollar, but that it also has to do with the jobs that they take, with the jobs that women take in order to accommodate their families and accommodate the needs of their families. And that's one explanation for the inequality, but it also has to do with some residue of uncertainty about whether or not you're getting a person you'll be able to get along with in the workplace if you hire a woman, and especially if there are men mostly in power in that particular business or corporation.
Absolutely.
So I think Hillary would make a difference here.
Well, I certainly think we know who you might be voting for.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And this was something I would tell my students, this is what I'm going to do, and this is why. But, what you do is your own decision. So,
of course.
Yeah.
So shifting gears a little bit, as we're winding down to the final couple minutes of this particular series, and again, I would love to have you back on at some point because we could talk probably for many, many episodes about the various current events and everything going on.
Mm-hmm.
But Sarah, what is it about what you've done over the years that you are most proud of?
Well, I feel as though I've been very fortunate. I chose a profession which is a very human profession, and it's a profession in which there is still, in the little small college setting where I've taught, there's still a lot of face-to-face conversation. There is still effort to work together towards social change. So I've learned how to collaborate. I've learned how to, because it was a Quaker institution, listening is very important. So I've learned how to do that. And I'm proud that I now can participate in some community activities in which my Guilford experience is invaluable. I have just been in a series of meetings in Greensboro with a group called they call themselves the Anti-Racism Task Force. That's probably not the full term, but there is a groups that have been meeting for several years. There's a white caucus, there's a black caucus, and then the two caucuses meet together, which is a model of that has been employed in doing in various trainings of undoing racism or becoming an actively anti-racist institution. We did it at Guilford years ago, and it's something I've been concerned about. So I feel like I bring to the table, years of having of appreciating listening to other people, listening to different points of view, learning how to respond, and so on. So that's that I think has been really valuable to me and personally as I go forward in this new adventure called retirement.
Absolutely. And on the topic of retirement, what are some of the things that you've been enjoying doing with your time now?
Well, thank you for asking that. I have been active in this. I've just actually reconnected with this anti-racism group in the community, which is dealing with police issues like education equality, and the Guilford County school system is anxious to try to close the gap by the third grade of reading levels and so on of children from different backgrounds. I also have been working with the Jewish community. I have been chair for the last 3 years, and I hope this is the last year of the Triad Jewish Film Festival, which is a lot of fun. I work with a committee organized through the Jewish Federation, and we look at many too many films, many films, and then select six to show at the festival, which takes place usually in February or March of the following year. So I'm already beginning to do that process. I love to be outside. I have the beginnings of a garden. It's been raining, and I haven't done it fully, but I love that. And I also, retirement also gives me an opportunity to spend much more time with my family. I have three children who live all over the country, one in Atlanta, one in D.C., and one in Spokane, Washington. And there are seven grandchildren. My daughter in Spokane has four children, and my son in Atlanta has three children. And so this is a special pleasure to be able to go when I can. I mean, going to Spokane is where I use my frequent flyer miles because it's far and it's expensive. And I also have a 95-year-old mother, and so I want to spend time with her. So I'm able to, I'm able to do that without carrying a pile of papers across the country with me, trying to grade them while I'm, in my quiet moments. So that's something that I really appreciate. It also is, so I have time with my family. I have time to be involved in these community activities. And I see my role kind of as a mentor, to younger professionals. a young woman who lives in Durham, who's on the faculty at Guilford in the Religious Studies Department, spends the night with me a couple of nights a week. And so I have a chance to talk to a younger person and to talk to her about her career development and to talk to her about, you know, what it's like to be a woman professional in a, you know, in a small institution and so on. And so I, you know, I've done that for a few people, to act as a kind of mentor, that the experience that I have can be, I hope, you know, you never know, but this is like teaching.
Right.
It can be helpful to help someone else grow in their career and in their personal development. So that's a general thing that I'm interested in doing.
Very nice.
I'm also,
we're running out of time for today's show.
Okay.
But again, always a pleasure to have you on, and
we
do wish you the best of luck. And again,
if you
have some time down the road, please come back to us, and we would love to speak with you again.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
All right. And from everyone here at Empire Radio, we'd like to say thank you to Sarah Molino, and thank you for all the listeners, and have a great day.
Bye.